This Week in Free Energy.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
Yeah, greetings, listeners. My name is Ken Rasmussen, and I'm filling in today for Sterling Allen of the PES Network. He's the webmaster over at freeenergynews.com. And you can see a list of upcoming shows and past archives at freeenergynow.net. And view the news daily at freeenergynews.com. Once again, my name is Ken Rasmussen, and I'm filling in for Sterling today. He had to attend a wedding over in Oregon, and he was afraid that he'd have his face full of wedding cake and mints about this time of the afternoon, so he asked me to fill in for him. I'm the host of another show on another network that also deals with new energy technologies. So the guest that Sterling has lined up for us today is Mark Golban from Energetics, spelled Ergenics, ergenics.com. So, Mark, welcome to the program today.
Thank you, Ken. It's a pleasure.
I got called in a little late on hosting this program, so I'm going to try to ask some intelligent questions here. But you are the CEO of the company.
That's
and
correct.
Looking at the website from the synopsis that Sterling set up over there at PES, you do have some fascinating products and some new technologies that I'm sure our listeners would like to know more about. So if we can open up here with, let me first give out the website address of your company. If we can give that out first, so if anybody's listening here in the archives, they'll be able to look over at your company.
By the way, I just want to break in here. We do have the president of the company on with us, too, Dave DeCosta. So
fantastic.
Hello, Ken.
Yeah. Greetings, Dave. Okay, like I say, your website is the usual www.ergenics.com. And so we can reference whatever else we talk about today from that website. So if anybody wants to see visually what we're talking about, that helps, especially here on the Internet. So, Mark, if you can give us a brief history of what your company has done and what direction it's headed now.
Very good. We are involved in metal hydride technology, which is metals that have been found to absorb hydrogen gas. And we were formed back in really 1979. And I came on in 1980. Basically, our products have been many. In the beginning, we were involved with storing hydrogen in metal hydrides for storage applications for not necessarily fuel cells, but IC engines. And we continue to do that. We have kind of branched out on different areas over the years. We have made things like compressors, metal hydride compressors. There's a function of the hydrogen going into the metal. And when that happens, there's a generation of heat, exothermic reaction. And when the hydrogen leaves the metal, there's an endothermic reaction requiring heat. And so we've made things like a compressor technology, where we can take hydrogen at a low pressure, absorb it into the metal hydride, and heat the hydride up with hot water and create a higher pressure. This function is an exponential function, very much like a vapor pressure of a fluid. If you take a fluid and heat it up, you'll get an exponential increase in pressure, very much like the Clausius-Clapeyron equation for a fluid. Our equation is a Van Hoff equation, and it's really a metallurgic reaction. The hydrogen, which exists as a gas, as we all commonly know it, actually turns into a metal. When it reacts with the metal hydride, it turns into a metal, creates this heat. You absorb roughly about one hydrogen atom for every metal atom, and until you saturate it, the alloy. These alloys can be designed to exhibit whatever pressure you desire for whatever temperature you desire. So that's a process of alloying it initially. When we melt it, we put in the right elements to essentially to develop any plateau pressure we desire. And this has really created the key to what we're trying to do here, which is the heat engine work. Again, the company has existed for well over 20 years, but the heat engine is where we feel this technology is really going to find its niche, and that is the ability to use this compressor technology and multi-stage it to allow this hydrogen to be absorbed in various stages of metal hydride and develop very high pressures with a very low temperature input. And
well, I'm sure all of our listeners are familiar with the compressor on your refrigerator, which deals with Freon. What kind of technical challenges did you encounter with the compressing and expanding of hydrogen, though?
Well, it's really the same way. I mean, compressing hydrogen with with the metal hydride, you can compress hydrogen as well as any other gas with a mechanical compressor. The metal hydride is unique in that there's really no moving parts. You're essentially taking metal hydride alloy contained in heat exchangers and heating them up with high temperature fluids like hot water and increasing the pressure that way. So it's actually a much easier technology. There's no moving parts, and it's a much more reliable technology, and it's quiet.
You've got a pretty impressive video there on your website that Sterling has links to, showing you simply immersing your two sensors, shall we say, in two buckets, a bucket of hot water and a bucket of cold water, and you're immediately generating electricity. Could you elaborate a little bit more on just
sure.
exactly what's going on with that process?
Very good. If you look at that, you do have a bucket of hot water and a bucket of cold water. You have two hydride. The things being immersed in there is the metal hydride heat exchangers. Those are copper tubing with hydride alloy inside it. Same hydride alloy in each of those heat exchangers. And by dipping it into the hot water, you're increasing the hydrogen pressure, the discharge pressure of the hydrogen leaving the metal hydride. And that creates a pressure differential. In that case, what we're looking at there, the pressure rise is about a 5-to-1 pressure rise. And that's enough pressure to turn an air motor. It's really a hydrogen motor now because we're using hydrogen instead of air, but basically it's a piston air motor. The hydrogen spins that air motor and extracting work. We have the air motor is connected to an electric generator. And by spinning an electric generator, of course, you generate electricity, which powers a light. And it leaves the air motor at a lower pressure, which is then reabsorbed by the metal hydride being cooled in the cold water. And that's a reversible process. After you've completed your initial power cycle, you can reverse the coils and dip the other coil down in hot water, and you're doing the same thing over again. It's a batch process. This is essentially cycled back and forth. The important thing for people to realize is that this can be done automatically too. You can have valves controlling your hot water flow and your cold water flow. And so all that is done, obviously, without moving anything around, just with the valves cycling back and forth.
Yeah, that was rather impressive in the video, the fact that it's not really polarized, that you don't have to have one sensor in hot and the other in cold. It works either way,
right.
Almost like an alternating current there. What level of BTU differential do you need to have it work? If you just had lukewarm water that's 75 degrees on one side and 74 on the other, can you actually get a reaction out of that, or how much temperature differential do you need?
You can get a reaction with a very low temperature. Really, for instance, I've done just a few degrees, just the heat from my body. I put a heat exchanger against my stomach, and you can get power. But and work, but the key is economics. You can get something to work almost like a Stirling engine. Everyone, I think maybe many of your listeners have seen a Stirling engine work, where they put something on top of a heat source and it runs, but it's really not producing much power and certainly not doing it economically. And that's we feel that we need in order to become economical, we need about anything over 20 centigrade, we start being economical against you know, what we would call photovoltaics. I mean, ultimately we intend to make hot water via solar energy to run this. But so it's about 20 centigrade of heat. We can feel the economics can support a hydride heat engine. I have to tell you, we haven't made that connection yet. We have not done this with the solar connection. We're doing that now. But our economics are the whole history of metal hydride has been one of trying to improve our economics. We've made one of our videos on our website is that solar-powered water pump. And that was done actually over about 20 years ago. And their hope there was we could use, you know, the solar thermal to make to pump water. It actually made its own electricity, too. But it wasn't economical enough. So we've just continued to do our work around here, which is more of an R&D facility where we make storage systems for people and compressors. We made a hydride storage system for Cassini that went to Saturn, if everyone remembers, a couple years ago. For NASA, but we've improved the heat transfer economics immensely since then at solar-powered water pump, and now we've gotten to the point where our materials for these devices are very, very economical. We feel we're down to about 15 cents per watt electric watt installed in terms of capacity. However, our labor is still immensely costly, and so our goal here is to get the investment and get our labor portion much more economical. Then we feel then we will have a product that everyone can use.
Okay, so the 15 cent per watt, that's the cost of manufacturing your hardware.
Right.
Do I understand that correctly?
That's right.
But once the hardware is established, then it's simply a matter of as long as a temperature differential of 20 degrees centigrade or greater is provided to this unit, it pumps out those watts then free of charge, right?
Yeah, that's right. If you have the energy source for that, which is solar, you're right. That's the key is solar energy, we feel.
Uh-huh.
Is kind of the untapped resource.
Because we're working with Stirling and looking at other energy devices, we get a little confused at times when we start quoting cost of a unit, and it's not to be confused with the final delivery cost. This is right here where we're looking at the cost of the hardware, but once the hardware is in place and ready to go, then now all you need is a temperature differential then.
Right.
And apparently you like solar. Now, does it...
Those numbers don't include a solar collector. I'm sorry.
Right. So am I correct in assuming that this will actually work via any hot water source?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
so if you're close to a... So a geothermal facility, perchance,
sure.
could utilize this for a more direct method of going directly into electricity without building the big steam turbines and all the stuff that they're currently using.
That's right. That's right. You know, I want to make sure the listeners understand, too, that the efficiency of a device is very important, too. And so the lower the temperature of your heat source, the less efficient it is. So your economics have to take that into consideration. Ideally,
okay.
What we're looking for, that 15 cent per watt number is dealing with an 85 centigrade heat source and a 40 centigrade heat rejection. So your Carnot efficiency at that point is about 14%, and we feel when we get to mass production, we'll be at about 10% of thermal efficiency, converting thermal energy into work, electricity.
Mm-hmm. So this is now the process of the gas simply of the hydrogen gas simply going in and out of the metal hydrides. Are there moving parts? Because I know whenever the word compressor comes up, we start thinking of well, you got pistons and seals and all that to deal with. So do you have moving parts to deal with in this?
Well, we ultimately, and if you do look at our website, you'll see a hydraulic type of expansion device that we are going to be using initially here for the first prototypes.
Uh-huh.
But eventually that will be replaced with a turbine. And that will be the only essentially the only moving part. In terms of the compressor, the hydride compressor is one of, again, you know, you have hot water being piped and exposed to your metal hydride heat exchangers, mm-hmm. and cycling that with cold water back and forth, you develop your compression that way. The multi-staging is important here, and want to make sure I explain that well, is that you get a certain amount of compression with your first stage, and you can pass that higher pressure now to your second stage, which is designed with a different alloy, that that hydrogen higher pressure will now essentially be absorbed by the higher pressure alloy of the second stage. And then when you heat that alloy, you get an equal pressure ratio rise. And you can quickly develop thousands of PSI of pressure with just a few stages. This is done just because the compression rise is a function of, let's say, if you have a compressor rise of 3 to 1, your first stage puts out a 3 to 1 pressure rise. So if you start at a 10 psi, you would leave at 30 psi. Your second stage would absorb that at 30 psi and compress it to about 100 psi. Your third stage would take 100 psi and compress that to 300 psi. Your fourth stage would take 300 psi and compress that to almost 1,000 psi. And that fifth stage can take 1,000 psi and compress that to almost 3,000 psi. It's very important to note that people have a hard time understanding that, but it takes just as much energy to compress hydrogen from 10 psi to 30 psi as to compress it from 1,000 psi to 3,000 psi. Yeah, the energy equation is simply a logarithmic function of the pressure ratio, the pressure divided out divided by the pressure in. So that's, I want to make sure that people understand that that's where the power of this idea comes from.
I see. Do you have any electrical output performance numbers to quote, such as if you've got the temperature differential, and you say apparently about a 40-degree differential between 45 and 85 is optimum. So mm-hmm. if you have that, then what kind of volt and amps are you putting out of your generator?
Well, you can, again, in terms of the demonstration you see on the website, that's really just a demonstrator. That one mm-hmm. is only a 12-volt demonstrator. It puts out about 50 watts of power. Interestingly enough, if you watch that demonstration, I have to be very careful to slowly dip the heat exchangers into the hot water, because I could easily develop so much power as to you know, burn out the bulb. You know, that those heat exchangers out there can generate well over 2,000 watts of power in terms of compressed gas, not in terms of you need a bigger generator in order to convert that into electricity. We can, to answer your question directly, you know, once you have electricity of any form, any, you know, voltage and current, you can invert that. You can do things to create whatever voltage and current you desire.
We believe
Tied into the same question, I guess, is how scalable is this? Because the demonstration we see there is actually a handheld device. It's just a little smaller than a picnic cooler is what you're using to dip into two buckets of water. But have you done larger scale production of this to see that it might actually replace one of these big coal-fired power plants someday?
Well, we envision that as perhaps two or three steps down the road. We think that we'll be introducing our first product in the 100 to 300 kilowatt range, believing that this would be good for flat-roofed industrial buildings in any industrial park across this country. Perhaps once experience is gained with respect to reliability, that we would be able to place these things on the roofs of box stores and essentially provide nearly 100% of the electricity consumed by the box stores that we all go to. Once we make some market penetrations there, I think, will always be examining the two opposite ends of the spectrum. One is locating solar panels in wide open areas that are not used for agriculture to go after the multi-megawatt size generators, where our economics actually improve with increasing size. But we also want to take a look at the domestic and home markets of scaling down to find out whether this technology could find some traction there also.
It's important to point out, too, Ken, that we have a modular heat exchanger technology. The heart of this technology is the hydride heat exchanger. That's the device that's really doing the conversion of the thermal energy into work or compressed gas, compressed hydrogen. And we've developed a very economical, very small and efficient heat exchanger technology that allows us to, and it's modular, so it allows us to mass produce, it allows us to stack them together and create whatever capacity of power output one is designing for. Obviously, if you have a high power output, you're going to need more solar collectors to run it, but we feel that the modular nature of our heat exchanger is what makes this economically viable. At the end of the day, it's economics. And by a modular heat exchanger, that becomes the product, so per se. That's what we're in mass production making and essentially using, if one application needs 100 of these, then that's how many go into the device. If another application needs 10,000, that's how many go into that device. So that's where we get the power of our economics.
Okay. Yeah, I'd like to clarify to listeners that your heat exchangers apparently are already in mass production then, correct?
No, we make them here. It's a custom basis right now in terms of our compressors. We are looking for an investment to get into mass production of those heat exchangers.
Mm-hmm.
And we very recently are examining mass production companies in China who we feel that's very exciting because the economics of mass production there could get this going a lot sooner and for a lot less money than we thought we would were looking at.
Yeah, many of the technologies that Sterling interviews on his show are totally in prototype stage and nowhere near manufacturing. So I guess the final thing is how soon does it look like that the consumers could actually see a 100 to 300 kW generator like you were speaking of?
We think that we're going to be in a position to have 10 or a dozen beta units into a few prime customer applications about this time next year. After experience is gained with those, at the same time we should be ramping up to get into production for our initial product introductions perhaps 6 or 9 months after that.
Okay. Is your company currently a closed corporation or public? What is the structure of the company that you've got?
We're a privately held company. This company had its origins with INCO Limited, International Nickel Company, going back to when these remarkable alloys were developed in the 1970s. The technology was acquired from INCO in 1984, and Ergenix was set up as a private company at that time. We did a number of mostly research and development projects, which just continuously refined the technology up to today. About 3 years ago, we were acquired by a Canadian company whose focus was developing hydrogen storage systems for automobiles. And about a year ago, Mark and I had an opportunity to acquire this facility from the Canadian parent, and we did. So now we have a group of four individuals who own the company. We're currently staffed at a level of six people. Depending on the amount of work and the different projects going on here over the past few years, we've been as high as 30 people and as small as four. So it's hydrogen is an area that only in the last 3 or 4 years is it now possible to bring hydrogen closer to people than the refinery or Cape Canaveral. With the emphasis on fuel cells, finally codes and standards are being developed that have now permitted an atmosphere where people are more willing to accept hydrogen getting a little bit closer to the consumer. And this is a perfect time for us to be looking at alternative energy as well as the adoption of codes and standards will allow us to cite these things where we need to cite them.
I think it might be interesting to relay a little story that addresses something like that. A number of years ago, we won a Discover magazine, I think it was 1998, for a cold start heater. And that is a device that we use this metal hydride technology to quickly heat up a catalytic converter for a vehicle. And we did we tested it at Southwest Research Institute and had some extremely good results. And
eliminating cold start emissions. In fact, this when the car was started, it would heat the exhaust up from ambient temperature to 400 degrees centigrade in 2 seconds. The catalytic converter would light off immediately, and you'd eliminate cold start emissions, which, of course, produce 85% of the total emissions from a car. So we were able to take a relatively dirty automobile and turn it into an ultra-low emission vehicle by California standards using metal hydride heating.
And we were even able to show that we could do that with, you know, turn essentially eight, you know, cylinder vehicles into ultra-low emission vehicles. So it was very exciting. We had some car companies very interested, and we actually walked into a major meeting for a major automobile company. And we were all thought that this was all going to take off here, and in walked one of the executives of the automotive company, and he said, "So this is the company that wants to put a hydrogen bomb under every vehicle in America." And that was all it took to lose the interest. And that reason why I mentioned that is, you know, we've had our, you know, that was very disappointing, but it, you know, essentially the atmosphere has never been better than now for a hydrogen product. And now the car companies themselves are, you know, looking at fuel cell vehicles, of course, and have gotten over their fear there.
Let me dig into that technical aspect for a moment here. Metal hydrides that I'm familiar with, going way back to, I first learned about them in the 70s. Metal hydrides, and shucks, the first one I learned about was iron titanium hydride, and then there's been a long list of types since then. Their main selling point was the fact that it was slow absorption and slow release. And that the selling points that the proponents at that time were pointing out was that if you were to use this method of hydrogen storage on your automobile, that you would never have an explosion because there's just no possible
right.
way of the hydrogen releasing from the storage that fast. And yet you apparently now have a method to release it fast enough to where the simple pressure release is to be utilized. Could you elaborate a little further on
sure.
the difference between the two there?
Yeah, gladly. You really hit upon the key of what we're doing, which is heat transfer. The actual kinetics of the metal hydride are extremely quick, you know, less than, you know, in a few milliseconds. Essentially, the reaction of hydrogen with the metal to create a metal hydride. What is really what they consider, you know, these sources that you are quoting when they talk about the slowness, that essentially at that point it becomes a heat transfer problem. You've made the reaction, and now in order to continue the reaction, you need to, in the case of absorption, you need to transport the heat that's generated out of the system, get it away from the metal hydride, so that more hydrogen can be absorbed. That's a heat transfer problem. And hence, yes, that's been the problem. The hydride storage devices such as what we're doing for compressors have always been very slow due to heat transfer. We have increased our heat transfer literally hundreds of times, if not close to 1,000 times over the last 20 years. And that enables a device, because it's a batch process, if you had a device that took 2 hours to have its heat transfer at one point, and now you have a device that takes 15 seconds, you know, you have something that's hundreds of times faster. So that addresses economics. Now your device can be 100 times or so smaller, have 100 times less material, and therefore be 100 times less expensive. So that's what's driven the economics here, is the fact that our heat transfer has gotten so much better. We could design a system for a storage vehicle. In fact, we just did. If the readers or the listeners do go to the website, they'll see a mine loader. We built a hydride storage system for a mine loader, and that device will absorb its hydrogen in under 10 minutes, which is the fastest and we believe the largest hydride storage device ever made for a vehicle. And we, as Dave mentioned earlier, with the cold side heater, we've done the absorption in a few seconds, 2 or 3 seconds.
And yet, getting back to your point, Ken, of the accident situation, the mine loader vehicle storage tank, while it has, it's designed to transfer heat rapidly enough to fill quickly, safety was a primary concern for storing hydrogen in solid form in an alloy in the first place, and that unit has been designed to slowly release hydrogen through physical constraints. And maybe Mark can expand on that just a little bit.
Well, that's true. We did that basically, had a design in for the different scenarios, and we did, were able to do that by essentially choosing the flow path for, you know, in terms of how it would, the most likely scenario of a rupture, if it was, say, someone crashed into it or things like that. And therefore, it was not heat transfer related in those situations, but more pressure drop related and able to meet the very strict constraints or something like that in a mine. And but so the to get back to your original statement, yes, metal hydrides are the safest way to store hydrogen. I cringe when people talk about 10,000 psi hydrogen in a storage device, such as a pressurized tank. I would never drive around with something like that. And where a metal hydride, you're sitting at about maybe 20 or 30 psi, and maybe eventually in a vacuum. Where there no hydrogen can come out, that is the way to go. We feel, you know, the safety aspects are obvious, and the high pressure storage is really not going to happen.
Yeah, handling hydrogen is a challenge for everybody whoever has to deal with it. The energy webpage I run is over at commutefaster.com, and I just had a story recently of a submarine, a British submarine, just had an explosion. It was doing some research underneath the Arctic, and they had an onboard explosion, and sorry to say, two sailors were killed. And the news just came out this last week that what had caused the explosion, but the onboard electrolyzer had malfunctioned, and apparently oxygen went the wrong direction, or the hydrogen went the wrong direction, but when the two mix, you've got a problem. And it can be a serious issue, but then again, the Navy has always taken a brute force approach to everything they do, and they rely more on brute force than they do technology. And as far as how they electrolyze, they have, of course, they've got an onboard nuclear reactors. They've got all the electricity in the world that they could ever use. So you combine all those massive forces together, and you've got a potentially dangerous situation. But by the slow absorption techniques here with the metal hydrides, that drastically reduces the explosion factor. Follow-up question here. So do I understand correctly then that your company is the one who has created these specific metal hydride alloys?
Well, that's kind of an interesting question. We did create the alloys, many of them in question, ourselves back in the 80s, but not the first ones. Really, the first alloys were created by Philips Lab in the Netherlands, and they really had the primary patents on it. Unbeknownst to us, it was actually a number of years before we realized that our patents did not predate theirs, and that was hard to take, but... they're very good in their patent position, and so we have developed our own alloys, alloys which have the basically the thermodynamic properties that we need for these devices. But we other people do have those alloys too, for similar alloys.
I just have a lot of personal respect for the chemists who come up with the combinations to create the alloys that do amazing things. I worked about 11 years with Lockheed Aircraft, and saw the exotic aerospace metals they had to deal with on the various planes that they were making during my tenure there. And it's just amazing stuff here, and chemistry has always baffled me. It's just way too complex to see just what ions are jumping over to what atom and what orbit and all the factors that are involved in there. So I've got the utmost respect for the chemists who come up with this.
Oh yeah, and it continues to amaze me too. We have a demonstration we do for people here where we'll have a metal hydride full of hydrogen connected through a valve to another container with metal hydride that doesn't have any hydrogen in it. You open the valve, and Dave said earlier, you know, immediately one frosts up, and you know, as it discharges its hydrogen, and the other, you know, steams up, or you create, you know, boiling water temperatures just by the hydrogen entering it, and that's done instantaneously. And the alloy that do that is I'm still amazed, and I've been doing it 25 years.
And they're reversible. You can repeat the process over a million times.
Well, tens of millions, yeah.
Without degradation,
right?
Yeah, well, that's proof in itself that we don't have a chemical reaction going on here. We simply have a physical pressure reaction.
Well, it is chemical. The hydrogen is actually bonding with the metal and making a different alloy with different, somewhat different properties.
It's very strange to think of hydrogen as a metal, but essentially that's what it is, and it is something that I call it a metallurgical reaction as opposed to a chemical reaction.
I guess I better return that is that it is a reversible reaction. It is not like a weld or an element becoming a compound. It's not an irreversible process. It is a reversible process.
That's right.
Of which there is no consumption of anything in the process besides just moving the energy back and forth. Right? Is that a better way to determine it?
Yes, that is. It's driven by pressure differentials and temperatures, but it is hydrogen turning into a metal as it absorbs into the metal, and turning back into a gas as it leaves the metal hydride.
Like you, Ken, I'm in awe of the scientists that develop and analyze these metallic structures using somewhat extraordinary analytical equipment to try to locate where the hydrogen is lodged between which metal atoms and things like that. In more of a layman's view, I envision in the old-fashioned model of the hydrogen molecule before quarks, I envision the hydrogen molecule, which of course has two hydrogen atoms, coming in contact with the surface of an alloy particle. There's enough catalytic activity on the surface to actually dissociate the hydrogen molecule into its two atoms. The protons then go directly into the metal lattice and lodge and form bonds with the metal atoms. And what's truly extraordinary is the volumetric energy density that you can achieve this way. You can actually store more hydrogen in an amount of metal powder than you can if you were to condense it at cryogenic temperature and liquefy it. And so you think, well, how could that be? And the way I envision that is when you locate a fat metal atom between two hydrogen protons, the forces associated with Brownian motion that keeps a gas as low density as it is, or a liquid, are eliminated, and you can actually pack lots of protons into this metal lattice.
Well, essentially the density of a metal crystal is closer than a liquid.
All right.
I think several auto manufacturers need to take a closer look at this method that you've got, because the much touted BMW's first hydrogen powered car, I think, is the Series 7. As best I read, they're still using compressed liquid hydrogen, and they've got you have to be honest, they're carrying that onboard bomb.
Well, the liquid has. You know, the liquid does have advantages in that the weight, there is a weight penalty for the metal hydride. And so, I mean, there are interesting reasons why people are using liquid. But I kind of agree with you. I would rather be with a hydride with me if something were to happen.
Yeah. Well, I've reached the end of the main questions that I wanted to ask you. If you can just elaborate a little further on your company. I know looking at your website, I'll give it out again. It's ergenics.com. And I see you do have a variety of other products and stuff that you're working on. If you just kind of hop around on what else your company is doing, I'm sure we'd like to know about it.
All right. Very good. Well, we're more of an R&D company, at least that's our history, as Dave was explaining. And we do research for people. We do hydride examination. We do the metal hydride compressors. But what the recent advancements we've done here with the heat exchangers and getting that essentially to get the cost aspect of the materials down, we see the tremendous potential here for the alternative energy route, to be able to make electricity from solar energy, from solar thermal energy is you know, astounding, the potential that's there. Everyone knows that solar energy is the most abundant form of alternative energy available. And to be able to, and the economics of making hot water from solar energy is very powerful. It's the easiest, most economical way to use solar energy is to make hot water. So tapping into that, we believe once you know, if you can make electricity and do that economically from solar thermal, it's not a big jump from there to actually use electricity now to make hydrogen. You can electrolyze water to make hydrogen. And
yeah, I'd like to interject an observation here. I'm currently located in the high desert in Southern California, and I'm not too far from my, as best I understand, one of the largest solar facilities in the world called Cramer Junction. And when you drive by that facility, it's 1,000 acres of mirrors, which somebody who worked there told me they have to wash every night to keep the dirt off the mirrors. When you compare that technology to the one we're speaking of today, what Cramer Junction has to do is focus 1,000 acres of mirrors on these tubes, I guess, or Pyrex, of which they pump a black fluid through it and really get the fluid up to a scorching heat temperature, and then route this black fluid, I guess it's some type of an oil, then over to their boilers, where they then boil off water and get all this heat concentrated on this big boiler, which then runs their steam generators. The point is that they have to have temperatures above boiling for their system to work. And when the sun sets and they can't get boiling water anymore, they aren't putting out 1 watt of electricity. What we're looking at here today is something that, at, as you say, 85 degrees centigrade, and you're developing electricity.
That's apparently a
much more efficient system here. So go ahead and elaborate.
Well, it's not more efficient, but the more economical, and that's the key. Is that you know, the use of making hot water with solar collectors, it's more economical and less maintenance. As you talked about, the mirrors need to be washed. Much less maintenance, much less cost to install those solar collectors and to make them. And that's where the key is of what we're trying to do. It's always been a matter of economics. I can think of a very interesting conversation I had with an energy analyst from a large company, one who was questioning the viability of solar, and he was essentially saying it was not going to be viable. And I said, well, there's not an energy analyst in the world who will disagree with my next statement, and that is that solar energy can supply all of the world's energy needs. And he got red in the face, but he didn't say anything. And I said, and they won't disagree with my next statement, that most believe it'll be another 50 years before it's economically viable. And this man slammed his fist on the table and said, 100 years. And I said, okay, all right. But understand what you've just acknowledged. You've acknowledged that one day, you've acknowledged that the potential is there and that one day that's what we're all going to be using. Our only disagreement is the amount of time it's going to be before it becomes economically viable. You think 100 years, I think it's 5 years.
Ken, yeah. One of the aspects of this that we have not talked about this afternoon or this evening is a little twist on the technology that instead of just generating electricity with solar hot water, some of our potential partners feel that there might be more value to them to use solar hot water to produce cooling for HVAC systems or chillers. And if listeners to this program do go to the website and you click on the heat pump button, you'll then see an air conditioning location that describes a little bit about how we use the cooling effect of a metal alloy releasing hydrogen to produce air conditioning at high efficiency.
And the exciting thing there is that if you do size your solar thermocollectors, your low-grade thermocollectors, economic thermocollectors, you size that for producing, for instance, residential heat in the wintertime. When you do get to the summertime, you have all this excess capacity, which can't be used or is not usable. You've made all the hot water you need for your shower. And what's exciting here is we're going to be tapping into that to make air conditioning for the home. There you can use that heat to essentially make cooling for the home. There are other technologies that can do the same thing. Everything we're talking about here can be done by other technologies, even the heat engine aspect back in the Carter administration, the OTEC project used low-temperature heat sources to make power, but it wasn't economical. So the point to point out is that it is boils down to economics, and it makes solar thermal much more viable in every aspect, cooling as well as power generation.
Mm-hmm. Well, definitely. If your process will create electricity, then you can take electricity in any direction you want then.
Well, that's true, too. Yes.
Yeah.
Right. In this case, though, rather than going to the intermediate step of electricity, we can use just the hydride cycle to produce chilling or air conditioning. We've done a couple of interesting projects recently. One was looking at replacing the conventional air conditioners on cars with a hydride air conditioner. There are certain places, primarily countries that have signed the Kyoto Protocol, where the R134a refrigerant that is now used in most refrigeration systems turns out to have a high global warming potential, which it's about 1,300 times higher than CO2, and countries are interested in reducing the release of any global warming potential material. And in Europe, for example, they're looking at alternative refrigeration systems. And we had worked with a European car company to demonstrate that hydride air conditioning could be used on board a vehicle and that it was delivering about double the efficiency of today's air conditioners that use R134A. Another project that we had an opportunity to participate in was looking at using the diesel exhaust from a military vehicle to produce direct cooling for the cabin of the vehicle to keep its occupants not only comfortable, but to condense water which could be reprocessed for drinking water should the cabin have to be bottled up for a few days in a biological warfare situation. Mm-hmm. In this case, we produced an air conditioning unit that was powered just by exhaust heat from a diesel engine. The demonstrator produced 8,000 BTUs per hour at 47 degrees Fahrenheit, and it weighs 13 pounds. So compared to, for example, a window air conditioner that people may be familiar with, we're a fraction of the weight and a fraction of the size to produce a tremendous amount of cooling. And this is all brought about by this chemical reaction. When we release the hydrogen, the alloy, you need to put energy into the alloy. You take that energy from air, and it gets cold. So there are many opportunities for this technology beyond just the solar thermal electricity generation.
It thrills me every time I hear more clever and I won't over-embellish and say brilliant. I'll just say intelligent application of energy. You've got excess therms here. You move it over to where you have a deficiency of therms. And this is the way our whole industry should be looking at is proper intelligent engineering. And the rhetorical question I have to toss out, and I'm sorry to say the answer to this question is politics, but why is the stuff that's available to the consumer so grossly inefficient? And especially when there are processes like this available now.
Well, I think the problem is not politics. The problem is economics. I think if it was economically viable to people, they would be using it. And that's what we've been trying to improve upon. Like I said earlier with the OTEC, I mean, people have been able to, not efficiently, but be able to use low temperatures to produce power, but not do it economically. That's the key. I think every politician would jump on this, no matter what side of the aisle you are on, if it was economical. And we think we have the solution to the economics of solar, and would love to talk to people and bring them in here and show you what we're doing and where we think this can go. But it is economics. If you're not going to be competitive with fossil fuels, no one's going to be interested in you.
There's another element of inertia that we've been doing things the way we do them for so long, it is hard to change direction. And one of my fears as we look into the future and we begin to look for alternatives of this addiction to petroleum that we certainly have in this country and the Chinese have, and it's only going to get worse. I watch commercials from the coal industry talking about having 250 years of fuel resources to power America and not to worry. And the question in my mind is, at the moment, it's not economic enough to go after some of these coal reserves because oil and petroleum is less expensive to pull out of the ground. But once the petroleum prices increase, can coal develop itself less expensively than clean technologies? And it's my concern is that it will be so easy to continue using fuels based on fossil fuels than look into alternative fuels that we may be compounding our CO2 problem. Sequestration aside, it's hard to imagine injecting that much CO2 into the ground. I think it's best not to burn it in the first place. We should be using these petroleum resources for materials, not as a fuel, and preserving that resource for the future while relying on solar energy.
But yeah, we may have 200 years of coal left, but we only have 50 years worth of lungs left is the issue. So pollution is it. I guess we can close here. I see we're just about out of time. We can close on the fact that economic inertia is probably the most difficult energy to deal with here. Again, time has just flown away. So I want to thank both you gentlemen, Mark Goldman, CEO, and Dave DaCosta, the president of Ergenics at ergenics.com. And so you're welcome to go to the site, and I want to thank Sterling for allowing me to host the program today. And my apologies for such an abrupt end to the show, but I wasn't paying close enough attention to the clock here.
Well, you're welcome, Ken, and thanks so much for having us on. Thank you, Ken.
Goodbye. Okay, we appreciate your time. Thank you so much. Goodbye, and be sure to get your news there at Free Energy Now and freeenergynews.com. Thank you much.